Thanks for listening to the History Today podcast. In this episode, we welcome the historian Charles Freeman, who explains his new research into the origins of the Shroud of Turin.
At History Today, we've been very excited by a remarkable piece of historical detective work, which we're very proud to publish in the November issue. It's by Charles Freeman, distinguished historian of the ancient world and an expert on the cult of relics, who has taken a fresh, in-depth look at the origins of the Shroud of Turin. Now, this is, or at least has been so far, one of the great unsolved mysteries of history. So I want to ask Charles, who joins us here in our new offices, what prompted you to this remarkably detailed and, as it turns out, very illuminating investigation? Because there has been a great deal of research already on the Turin Shroud's origins.
Well, at first I neglected the Shroud of Turin in my book on medieval relics because it was never an important medieval relic. It was one of the many hundreds, perhaps even thousands of cults that came and fell. But it was only when I was researching for a tour I was going to take in Turin, basically looking at the Baroque architecture of the 17th and 18th centuries, that I found an engraving showing the shroud in a wonderful panorama of an exposition of probably of 1613, in which massed crowds, fusillades of gunfire, and every kind of drama as was associated with the unfurling of the shroud. And when you actually looked at the shroud, and it was an engraving by a very well-known engraver of his day, Antonio Tempesta, known for meticulous work in other subjects that he'd painted and engraved, I could see that there were all kinds of features on the images on the shroud which today have vanished. Immediately, this made me think, we're not looking today at a shroud which was as it was. And if you look at the mass of research that has been done by the so-called shrouders, and they're quite happy to be called that, most of them seem to assume that what you look at now in Turin, in an exposition coming up next year in 2015, is the shroud as it originally was. And they have tied themselves up into knots, trying to work out how possibly this image could have been created. But in fact, if you take as an assumption that this was a painted linen cloth from which the images have faded over centuries, supposing we can go further into this, that it was made in the, created and painted in the 14th century, it seems most probable, it over the centuries, inevitably, particularly with a large number of expositions in the 17th century, it was bound to decay and the images was bound to decay as it was thrown into all kinds of different expositions over the centuries. And once that basic assumption had been made, then a lot followed. First of all, you could actually look at the original features. Now, although Tempesta's engraving is probably one of the most accurate, we do have at least 50 more. It's a very rich subject which has hardly been looked at all. Because when you came to an exposition, you often could buy a little souvenir, a printed picture of the clergy of the day, sometimes the Dukes of Savoy, who owned the shroud in Turin, holding it in front of an audience, and you could therefore see from different artists at different times how they actually showed the shroud. And you could put together the features which are now lost, and one of them was the crown of thorns, which you can't see today. The other is in all the depictions since 1578, you find a loincloth, which has now disappeared. Some of them show thumbs on the figures, which are now no longer there. The other issue that comes up is when we look at the descriptions which survive of the shroud, everybody concentrates on the violence of the blood stains. These are still there on the shroud. You can still see them, but they are very faded. And the descriptions we have from the 15th and 16th centuries is that these were very vivid and really quite shocking in their realism. Now, immediately this begins to cause echoes of the blood cults, the blood cults of Christ, which are very prominent in the 13th and 14th centuries. If you go back to the 12th century, look at the imagery of the burial of Christ, you find there's virtually no sign of the wounds, occasionally a little sign of bleeding. By the 14th century, you have great emphasis on the flowing blood. Sometimes Christ is on the cross, the blood is flowing from his hands and angels are collecting it. The wound on the side that John mentions in his gospel flows with blood. The blood sometimes runs down the arms. And the closer you look at the blood stains on the shroud, the more you realize that actually these are very typical of the blood stains shown in the iconography of the burial of Christ in the 14th century.
And indeed, you draw comparisons with other works of that time as well.
Yes, there are some very good comparisons. The one I have used is the Holkham Bible. It's not really a Bible, it's a series of manuscript and depictions of scenes from the Passion of about 1330. It's now in the British Library in London, called the Holkham Bible, because it originally came from Holkham Hall in the library there in Norfolk. It shows the crown of thorns in place on Christ's face and his head, and it shows the blood stains running down his hair and across his brow, very similar to what we actually see on the shroud even today.
Strikingly so.
I at one point say it's almost like a template. It's almost like the artist who painted the shroud. And we need to come on to the question of the paint in a minute, but that the artist who painted the shroud was almost copying a template. And again, what actually clinches this further is that the blood flowing down the arms, which is very typical of the 14th century, is also seen on the arms of the man on the shroud. So that is fascinating itself. But what actually clinched it was something which was rather more intriguing, and that is that the marks of the flagellation of Christ, the scourging of Christ, that of course is recorded in the Gospels, on the shroud cover the whole body. Crisscross marks cover the whole body, and even today you can dimly see these on the shroud. Now, we have no evidence at all from earlier than 1290 is about the earliest I found. Other scholars have suggested 1300. Of an all-over flagellation like this. It just doesn't seem to exist in the iconography. And what actually caused what was quite a dramatic change in the way that the flagellation was represented seems to have been the attempt to search through the Old Testament to find premonitions, as you might say, of what Christ would suffer in his passion. And the particular verse that stood out was Isaiah chapter 1, verse 6, where it talks of someone who is beaten from the crown of his head to the tips of his toes. And it seems that this was the catalyst for actually creating in art the idea of Christ having been flagellated all over. And as I say, we've got no examples earlier than about 1290 or 1300. So we're coming closer, not only through the bloodstains, but also the marks of the flagellation, to really a 14th century image. Now, how could we sort of build on that? Well, the first question is, the iconography seems pretty clear that this is a 14th century image. We have the first documentary evidence is of the shroud in a chapel at Leary in northern France near Troyes, where it was exhibited in the 1350s by Jeanne de Chanet, who was the wife of a very prominent French knight, Geoffrey de Chanet, who was fighting with the King of France and was doing a lot of diplomatic missions for him in the 1350s and was going to die in Poitiers in 1356 in the wars against the English, the famous Hundred Years' War. She seems to have been on her own, as far as we can ascertain, in this chapel, and it's probably she and the clergy who decided to put up this painted cloth as a real relic, the real burial shroud of Christ. Very quickly stamped on by the local bishop. These were the traumatic years after the Black Death. Everybody was highly distressed and distraught, and many of these cults suddenly sprung up as people were looking for some kind of spiritual salvation in the drama following the enormous drop in population of the Black Death. But the bishop shuts it up, and for 30 years we don't hear about the shroud, and then it reemerges. Geoffrey de Chanet's son starts exhibiting again in 1390. But something dramatic has happened, that the anti-pope, Clement VII, the anti-pope, as he's not accepted in the legitimate lines of popes at a time when there were competing popes, accepts that this can be shown, it can be exposed, but it has to be said that every exposition, this cannot be, this is not the real burial cloth. Now, this is a really important point because it shows that the church did not think it was a forgery. It didn't think that anybody had been trying to deceive anybody. But what clearly has happened is something has given the shroud spiritual status. And the most likely thing is, because we have many hundreds of other examples, is that some kind of miracle was associated with it. It may have been, for instance, that in the 1350s, that although it wasn't, it was never, in fact, the burial cloth or believed by the church to be, that in fact somebody, some pilgrim who visited, recorded a miracle. And for some reason this stuck, and this was what gave the shroud a spiritual status, which allowed it to be venerated, and as it still is today, and that is the situation that Pope Francis has reiterated.
But we should make it clear, though, that there's absolutely no way in which the Church claims or has claimed that this is the actual burial shroud of Christ.
This is a little difficult to know because some of the popes, like Julius II, seem to have tended towards it. And in fact, he gave a feast day for the shroud, which is May the 4th. But in 1670, when the Dukes of Savoy were exhibiting the shroud virtually every year, as far as we can see, there was still a papal statement that this was not the real thing, but you could still get an indulgence for visiting it because it reminded pilgrims of the passion of what Christ had gone through. So that seems to be the status. So when people say, if it's not authentic, it must be a forgery, that's not true at all. Because it, first of all, and I think this is an important point to make, no one in the Middle Ages, no forger in the Middle Ages, making the burial cloth of Christ to deceive people, would ever have made a cloth like this. For a start, what do we know? They would only have had the Vulgate Latin before translations, of course, vernacular translations of the Bible, and it would have talked of orthonia in the Greek or lintia mina in the Latin of wrappings of Christ. The burial shroud was some kind of wrappings with a separate faith cloth, as John's Gospel makes quite clearly. Now, any faker would never get away with a large cloth with two images on it. Because if, for instance, John's Gospel had said that Peter went into the tomb and he saw a cloth lying there with an image of the risen Christ on it, then, of course, a forger would have to put one on. But if there is no mention, no one's going to be taken in. So I think we can rule out very easily that this is a forgery. This was created for some other purpose. And what is fascinating is to see what were the possible other purposes in which this painted cloth could have been created by an artist.
And of course, you come to this in the second part of your article.
I come in the second part. It took a lot of searching around. The first thing that's important to note is that painted linen hangings in churches of various sorts are very, very common. If you go back to the cathedral and church inventories, you often find some of them have hundreds of hangings. Some of these were basic hangings. They just were put up at different places in the church. For instance, where I live, Bury St. Edmunds, in the inventory of the great abbey there, has records of a lot of hangings in the great cathedral church, great abbey church, not cathedral, the great abbey church of where St. Edmund was supposed to have been buried. But very common, of course, were the Lenten veils, because in Lent, any kind of statue, any kind of opulence in the church had to be hidden up with cloth. And when I first started working on it, I thought this was a cloth that was used to cover an altar, because there are several of these. And we have the Parment of Narbonne, for instance, which is a very rare silk survival, painted silk, which does seem to have been created specifically at Lent to hang up behind an altar. But this didn't really work, and it was almost by chance that I was looking at some of the medieval liturgies that I came across the ceremony of Quem Quaeritus. Now, Quem Quaeritus is an Easter ceremony. I don't know if anyone in the church still follows it, but it's a fascinating ceremony because on Easter Sunday, they used to try and recreate within the churches, and many of the examples we have are from monastic records, of the the coming to the tomb, either the three Marys or Peter and the disciple that Jesus loved. Many people think it's John. Mm-hmm. It depended. You could pick and choose among your gospel scenes, but you would recreate it. And what they would do in the church, they would set up a tomb, sometimes very makeshift. It just seems to be in a sort of wooden structure with hangings on it. Other cases, and there's a nice example in Aquileia in northern Italy, they actually made a stone tomb from year to year. It was an actual recreation of the sepulchre in Jerusalem. And they would place, one of the priests would sit by it, pretending to be, acting out the angel who is mm-hmm. at the tomb when the three Marys or Peter and John arrive. And he says, whom are you seeking? Whom are you seeking? And they say, we're looking for Christ. We're looking for Jesus who was buried here. And he said that he is risen. And basically the liturgy, which went on chanting backwards and forward, basically said, if you don't believe me, go into the tomb. You will find it empty and the grave cloth are lying there. And they go in and they bring out a grave cloth and they hold it up in extenso, as some of the records say, in front of the congregation. And then there is a procession in front of the congregation and it is laid on the altar. Now, we don't know immediately what these cloths consisted of because probably, and this is what is the really exciting part for me, is that the shroud may be the only one that has survived. Mm-hmm. Linen decays very easily, damp, fire, all kinds of problems were associated with linen preserved over many generations could have assailed it. But we do discover that there are cases in Spain, for instance, some of the rites where it specifically says that the body of Christ was painted on the linen. And so we do know this happened. But what clinched it for me was going back to the pilgrim badge from Liri, which amazingly was found in the Seine in 1855, and is now in the Musée de Cluny in Paris, in the medieval museum there. And it shows two clergymen, or in fact, they are, you can hardly see, they're damaged, and you can only see their vestments, holding up the shroud. We know it is a shroud because it has the arms of Jeanne de Charny underneath it, and her husband, Geoffrey, and between the arms, there is an empty tomb. And this is exactly as the ritual, the liturgy of holding up the grave cloth is described in the monastic and other records. So I think this, I'm going to be a little cautious, but I think this is the best single explanation of the shroud. So what we actually have is what was created and painted, and I want to come back to the paint because I think it's important, painted as a stage prop, if you like, for one of these ceremonies. And then at some point, it was presumably used. It may have had miracles associated with it early on, because we have another example, which is now almost said it destroyed the French Revolution. It no longer exists. We think it was destroyed in the French Revolution from Besançon, which is a single figure, very similar to the shroud, but much earlier in the sense there's no blood stains. But it's a figure lying as the man on the shroud is with his hands over his pelvic area.
It's much cruder.
Yeah, it's a cruder. Yeah. And I think a lot of these grave cloths were basically created on the spot by a local artist who who knew what he was supposed to do, but wasn't able to do it very well. And I think this is maybe that the shroud is probably more sophisticated than that.
No.
But that we do, there is a record that was associated with somebody being risen from the dead, either touched or whatever. So we've got that possibility. And at some point, completely unknown, it arrived in Newry in the church there. I have, and I need some real expert help on this, but I have suspicions that the most likely provenance is southern Germany, because we do have the blood cults were very powerful there, and we do also have examples of what are called the holy graves in along the Rhine, which are figures very similar to the figure on the shroud, and so iconographically one might be able to link the Shroud's figures, and I do really, we really need to get some experts that to work on this to see whether we can pinpoint a southern German origin for the Shroud. We may never be able to pin it down, but that seems to me the most likely possibility. But since I wrote the article, there's one avenue which is, looks like it needs further exploration, and that is, I was reading an article that was written about copies of the Shroud. Now, it wasn't illustrated, so it was very difficult to know what they meant by copies of the Shroud, but a lot of so-called copies of the Shroud are to be found in Spanish churches. But the descriptions given in the article suggests that some of these may not have been copies of the Shroud at all. You can usually pinpoint the copies of the Shroud because the fire marks, which came from a fire in 1532, are shown in the genuine copies. Right. You can't really do a copy of the Shroud today without the very prominent fire marks, which are still there and are on all the images. So when you see a double image without fire marks, it's possible that this actually could have been another grave cloth. So we need a Spanish expert who's prepared to go around, dig around in the archives and look at some of these copies to see whether we can trace any of those back earlier than the Shroud. And it may even be that we do track down some other cases. At the moment, it looks like there may be one or two in Spain. But at the moment, let's cling to the fact that we've got the only one. and as such, I think it's important because for a number of reasons. I mean, one reason is that it's a possible solution. I'm not going to go further than that. The possible solution to the so-called great mystery of the Shroud. I personally think that this mystery has been overplayed because so much of the basic work on the iconography of the early descriptions and depictions has never been done properly. So that I think to call it a mystery when you haven't really done the kind of research that you'd have thought was the primary research, the search you begin with before you started calling something a mystery. But it's important, possibly as a solution, it's important in the history of drama because here was the beginnings of medieval European drama, because you can trace almost a direct line. People like Carl Jung in the 1930s were working on this, although they didn't mention the Shroud at all. Direct line from these Easter ceremonies within the church, where it seems that even the priest didn't even put on any costume. Everybody sort of knew what part they were playing, out into the passion plays of the medieval streets that we all know about. So in that sense, in the history of drama, I think the Shroud has an enormous importance. If this is indeed one of these grave cloths, the only stage prop of the birth of European medieval drama, which of course then feeds into Renaissance and later drama. But also, and I think there's another important reason, the church has never pronounced an authenticity. And it was the church which commissioned the radiocarbon dating, which came up with very much the same date as my iconography. I don't give a big part to the radiocarbon dating because I wanted to see whether you could actually prove the case on the iconography alone. Mm-hmm. And I think that's established, even if the radiocarbon dating had not taken place. I hope that I've established first half of the 14th century, possibly 1325 to 50 as the possible date. But we do have a radiocarbon dating, which says 95% certain 1260 to 1390. Which fits, of course, absolutely perfectly. But the church commissioned that. The church accepted it. It has never officially said that it does not believe that that is was a fair assessment of its age. But what we have created for the church is a spiritual significance for the Shroud. If we said, as many people do without thinking, if it's not authentic, if it's 1330, it therefore is a fake and a forgery, well, then it leaves the church in a bit of a mess. But if you're actually saying, as I think is correct to say, no, this is not a fake. It was never intended to be a fake. It was actually had a spiritual purpose. It had a function of being part of the great celebration of Easter. And as such, it is fixed right within the medieval spiritual ethos in a way that no fake or forgery would ever get near. So I'm hoping that the church can see this as from their point of view as an acceptable solution, because it, of course, does nothing to undermine the veneration in which the Shrine has been held now for over 600 years and will continue to be venerated in the great exposition they're planning for 2015.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Charles. It's a fascinating article, I have to say. And I think a convincing one. As you say, although obviously there is some more work to be done. But we're extremely proud to be publishing it. And congratulations on what you've done. It's available in the November edition of the magazine, on the digital edition, and on the website too. So I hope everyone enjoys it.